In fact, economic concentration polluter behavior and anti-competitiveness is an international problem, and organizations like the OECD has already designed interventions to reduce the harm arising from anti-competitive practices and mergers with anti-competitive practices. Yes. So there's an international view that anti-competitiveness, collusion, the behavior of cartels is unacceptable. It's not in the interest of economic growth. It's not in the interest of inclusivity. And hence the reason we are welcoming the bill in its current format. We welcome the bill and see it as correct interventions that will lead to a competitive economic climate, balancing the interests of workers, and that's important, the balance between the interests of workers, consumers, businesses, and development, which will benefit all South Africans. And for us, this is exactly what the bill intends to do, is to strike the balance so that it can benefit all South Africans, regardless of class and creed and background. The key impact of the amendments, we believe that some of the key amendments of the amended legislation will be that it will undo the concentration in the economy, which is very prevalent as we speak. It will promote investment. It will lead to a reduction in prices, because generally collusion, it leads to higher prices. The benefit is not coming to the consumer, and in particular the poor and workers in general. And a greater focus on jobs and the promotion of worker ownership, which is also important. I mean, we had one or two success stories, but that was rather the exception than the rule. That comes to mind the Walmart, Massmart merger, but one can safely say that was an exception rather than the rule. So we want to see more of those good structures coming out so that workers also can benefit out of this, and that is the intention of this bill. In particular, the bill focus on transformation, in particular the support for SMMEs, black-owned firms, which authorities should consider during mergers. I think that it's a very good instrument that the bill envisages to enhance triple BEE and the transformation of the economy. Fidusa supports this, it will ensure greater inclusivity and entry participation of black-owned firms, because currently there's a lot of restrictions and barriers in place for black-owned businesses to prosper and to become major players. I think the trend is that as a black business you become a small player. It's good to be an SMME, but the next step to becoming a big role player in the economy, that is not an easy task for a black-owned business or an SMME. The transition is impossible under current legislation. So we believe that this bill opens the door for those practices to ensure that through economic development and then we uplift those who have been prejudiced as a result of our past. We further welcome the proposed amendment of Section 12(i)(3) with the introduction of an additional test to public interest criteria applied to mergers. Chairperson, this is very important, this clause, namely the extent to which a merger will promote greater ownership, and I just alluded to it earlier, in particular by black South Africans and workers employed at the firm's concern. I mean, if one really wants to talk about broad-based BEE, this is an opportunity where one can have inclusivity, where all workers in South Africa can benefit in the event of a merger, or those things. This amendment will certainly empower workers by affording them a stake in the firm's concern and will lead to more inclusivity and equality. The proposed amendment to Section 43A of the Act will strengthen the tool of market inquiries to deal with economic concentration and can assist to deconcentrate the economy and allow for transformation of ownership and promotion of SMEs. Fidusa welcomes the proposed amendment, which will enhance the market inquiry process and to allow for trade unions and workers to participate in market inquiries. I think we are very encouraged by this proposed amendment, because for the first time we will really have an opportunity and the right as trade unions to act on behalf of workers where there is where there is problems like that, that we can join these market inquiries to ensure that jobs are being protected, to ensure that you know, greater economic development. So this is very, we really welcome this as part of the amendment. Currently, there is no provision in South African law that enables the executive to consider national security issues in a merger involving a foreign acquiring firm, which we've seen is becoming prevalent over the past couple of the last decade or so in South Africa. Major, with investment comes major players, multinational companies enter our economy, and it comes with its own problems and with its benefits. So I think it needs to strike a balance as one, how deal one with benefits and how one deal with some of the problems that it can create. We welcome the insertion then of a new section 18A in the bill, which provides for a national security veto if and when national interest could be adversely affected. And I think the focus is if and when, so it's not something that can be just triggered willy-nilly. It's really a safeguard to protect national interest. As I've indicated, the amendment to protect national interest and security is in line with many other legal systems elsewhere in the world. Chairperson, the United States of America has got a similar provision in their legislation. Canada, Australia, European Union, and even China. So the issue of national interest is very much important, and we particularly welcome this provision of the bill that will take care of our national interest. Because our sovereignty, I think, we will all agree, it's utmost important as a democratic and independent state. During the NEDLAC consultation process, we consistently argued that the current fines and penalties regime is very weak and does not act as a deterrent against collusion and anti-competitive practices. The review of existing penalty regime became more necessary due to the increased exposure of collusive practices by the competition authorities. Since 2010, the authorities have conducted a number of investigations against cartels and monopolies in a number of sectors, such as poultry, bread, construction, steel, auto components, telecoms. Now, Chair, for us, this is criminal. I mean, that's a crime against the poor. When companies like bread companies collude, it's the poor that suffers, because it's a major part of diet of many South Africans, but in particular poor people. So it is totally unacceptable that this collusive practices, and it hurts the poor and the working class tremendously. Now, that is our gripe with the penalties, Chair, because we believe that the penalties act as no deterrent to that. I mean, if one look at the percentage of turnover, I mean, that really means nothing. We hold the view that If you're a big company, you can even budget for those eventualities. If I know, because I will know upfront, if I do collusion for 5 years, I will know upfront what my penalties are. And all I have to do is to go and disclose and say that I'm very sorry that I robbed the poor by colluding with others in bread. That is criminal. That is unacceptable. So I think part of the positive outcomes of the bill, this is one of our gripes, where we say that we don't believe that the law is enough bite in it to ensure deterrent. It will certainly improve, but we are very skeptical that it might not give the desired results. But in essence, there is a lot of positive things coming out of the bill. Section 59 regulates the administrative penalties that a tribunal may impose. The proposed insertion of subsection 2A increases the maximum penalty to 25%, as you just alluded. Now, clearly, that our viewers, organized labor, we would have liked to see a 40%, 45% penalty in this regard, because, I mean, clearly 25%, it's a good, like, let's agree at least it's something positive. It's a major shift from where we are and where we're going to, but it needs to be seen whether, you know, this 25% really is going to act as a deterrent to stop this collusive practice. But we believe it's a step in the right direction, and we fully support this amendment. But we would have liked to see a much stricter, much higher penalty regime to really stamp out these practices, because while companies are paying fines, Jeff, they made super profits during that time. So it's not a situation where they don't make profits. They make super profit by colluding. And all they have to do is they just get paid the penalties and carry on with their lives. So that is a very, very sour point for us in Grant, that we, that's precisely our motivation behind a more stricter and harsher penalty regime that we wanted to. But we understand this is part of social dialogue and agreement. We could not secure higher, but we welcome the at least the increase in the penalties. During the NEDLAC process, also organized labor calls for a greater role of the executive in mergers. Workers expect policymakers to be responsible for mergers policy and intervene, especially where jobs, deindustrialization, distress sectors, or small businesses are at risk. FIDUSA therefore welcomes the provision of Section 17.1C, which allows the minister to appeal merger decisions under certain circumstances to the Competition Appeal Court, where the minister believed that public interest issues, including employment, were not duly considered. So this is a very, very crucial component of the bill, which we certainly welcome. In fact, as we speak, there are those cases whereby there's mergers taking place and one only realizes the negative impact. On paper, it looks good. And for a small period of time, it looks good. And I've been personally involved in some of those discussions where you see for 2 years, it's strange that the period that binds those conditions, everything goes well. And then after that, the wheels come off. Then one realized, but it was not actually a good, this was not a good merger. This was not in the interest of workers or even in the economy. So this is a very important intervention in this amendment that can really add value to those, especially those practices where jobs are at risk and deindustrialization, in particular, distress sectors. FIDUSA welcomes the proposed amendment to Section 9, which in essence makes changes to the price discrimination section affecting SMEs and black-owned businesses, who often are the victims of price discrimination, and inhibits the increased growth and participation in the market economy. We particularly welcome increased growth. We particularly welcome subsection 9.3, which requires the dominant firm to show that its action of price differentiation does not impede the participation of SMEs and firms owned by historically disadvantaged persons. This, in our view, will ensure greater entry and participation in the economy by all sections of society. So again, we really welcome this. This section into insertion in the bill, because it will really benefit the greater collaboration between economic sectors for the purposes of economic development, industrialization and protection, and creation of jobs is not always regarded as anti-competitive behavior. During the NEDLAC discussions, both organized labor and business expressed the view that the bill should allow for collaboration between firms in support of employment, sustainability and greater economic development. FIDUSA welcomes the amendment to Section 10, which seeks to introduce exemptions to allow for greater flexibility for legitimate collaboration. Chair, this is very important and it's certainly welcome. I think this is not as radical as a gentleman in the West called Mr. Trump, but I think when one talks about national interest, this is really when one can make that exception to say, if it's in the interest of jobs, if it's the interest of the country, let's then invoke those sections. So we really appreciate this part of the amendment. We further welcome the amendment which allows for the Commission to exempt an agreement of practice or a category of agreement of practices from application of Chapter 2 of the Act. The ground is competitiveness and efficiency gains that promote employment or industrial expansion, and I just alluded to it earlier. This proposed amendment is consistent with a broader industrial policy objectives of government and is most welcome. And here particularly we talk about IPAP, we talk about all this, the new growth path, all of these issues, and we believe that the section can certainly enhance those processes. FIDUSA support the amendment in Section 10.10, which will empower the minister to exempt an agreement of practice, which will allow for greater collaboration to support other policy instruments, such as buy local initiatives and support for labor-intensive and priority growth sectors. We've seen in other jurisdictions, the Americans have got Buy Back America. The Canadians has got other legislation that protect their local industries and businesses. So this is quite consistent with some of the international practices. In conclusion, Chair, Fidusa believes that by amending the Competition Act as outlined by the bill and subsequent agreements during the NEDLAC process will allow government to deal with some of the key structural challenges in the economy. Fidusa firmly believes that the amendments will change the competition regulatory landscape, usher in a new competition regime, and will assist the authorities to prosecute dominant firms for predatory pricing and particularly margin squeeze, which we know is hurting the poor and the working class the most. These amendments, we believe, is consistent to create and enable a developmental state based on competitiveness, because it's important to be competitive if one wants to compete globally and enhance economic development, job creation, greater equality, poverty alleviation, and transformation of our economy. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Fidusa, and the Global Union of Labor Workers. This stage, I'll allow members to have questions, and I request that you note all the questions, and you respond to all of them at once.
Yeah.
Any questions? Honorable Nkebe?
Thank you, Chair. In your submission, there seems to be, and for the very first time, Labour seems to be united in their submission, which is something very encouraging. But I think across federations, there has been an explicit demonstration that during your negotiations at NEDLAC, the majority of your non-negotiables were thrown out in trying to acknowledge that you need to also extend a leap of faith to the other side, being business. Are there anything that you think that were left out during this process, that process, that you think that sufficiently will make Fidusa agree to the amendment bill? I know that the process of negotiations, sometimes you take what you don't necessarily agree with on the basis that the spirit and the intent of negotiations is give and take. So is there anything that was left off that you think that it's a non-negotiable on the part of Fidusa, and you would want to lobby the committee to, in their wisdom, consider it, and then if they agree, assent to Fidusa's plea? The second part is, do you think that regulations will be enough to insulate what business has been able to do in the past? Doing something that is morally and ethically incorrect, and they budget for such eventuality. And as and when they are caught, they just buy their way out of it. Do you think that regulations will be sufficient to cap that? If not, what modalities should we employ to stop that? Thirdly, what is your view on the explicit view on the measure? Do you think that the court judgment that is now open to everybody to see has sufficiently addressed that? If not, what is it that we can be able to do in the future to avert the watering down of national security on the name of financial foreign direct investments, but also generally, measures, how do they affect your position as Fidusa? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Just to clarify, Honorable Tevez, that during the labor laws public hearings, labor was united. They had actually a joint submission on those labor laws. So I agree with you, that they are united. Perhaps in future we might have one federation, one country. Honorable Makul.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the presentation. Chair, I join in with the notion that there are similarities between what COSATU has shared with us, also what its research agency, Naledi, has shared with us. So that limits our questions, therefore, to SATU, amen, to Fedusa, because of your agreement already in NEDLAC on these issues. I would, however, want to pose two questions here. The one is, when you look at the policies related to beneficiation and localization, as a worker organization, are we sure that this legislation or this draft that is before us has taken that into consideration as well and would not hold us back in terms of that policy position? That's the first question. The second one is, Chair, that when we, because all three of you, being COSATU, Naledi, and Fedusa, is welcoming the participation of workers also at the higher echelons of decision-making within the corporate sector. Now, not understanding that, I would want to pose the question and say that how do we ensure, or are you sure that this legislation does provide that those workers won't be co-opted against the interest of the, you can call it the working class, or you can call it against the interest of the lower workers who are, the workers who are at the lower rung within a company. When we open up that space. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we have a response?
Thank you very much, Chair, and members, for the questions. I think, first of all, on the issue of organized labor and the unity, I think there are a number of occasions where we share with colleagues where we are united on issues of national interest, and I think in this particular issue, there's an issue of national interest, and we are quite also surprised even with our colleagues in business. Like I said, during the NEDLAC processes, there were some agreements reached. We not always see eye to eye, but there was a sense of working together, you know, in the national interest. So I think those elements were prevalent, and that indicates the importance of this piece of proposed legislation, because there's sort of broader consensus that it is in the national interest, and we will continue to work together as role players. Yes, on the issue of some of the non-negotiables, well, this is your part of the negatives of social dialogue. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and one decide on a strategic basis what is good and what is bad for you. So yes, Chair, some of the issues that labor feel that, and especially from outside, has been excluded is most probably the issue of fines and honing labels, because we really believe that if the law wants to bite, and if we really want to have a deterrent against collusive practices, then you must have a very, very strong and tight penalty regime. And we believe that whilst we appreciate the current penalty regime, but we don't believe it's strong enough. So if we wanted our way, we would have seen a much stronger penalty regime and much more stronger focus with regards to the warning labels. You can't warn a person, you can't reward a person for doing wrong. So you've colluded and there's a warning, there's a fine, you collude again and that. Although there is mechanisms built in, but we believe our view is you collude once, you get penalized severely so that you don't repeat that. on the next occasion and create negative consequences to the public at large. So for us, that's most probably that's part of the negatives coming out of the process that we were unsuccessful as organized labor to deal with. There's some other issues, well, but I don't want to go into too much detail, just the broader issues that we feel that we could not secure. And I think the issue of self-regulation as you speak currently, I mean, it's very much, there's an appeal to businesses that don't collude. Well, there is a Competition Act, but please don't collude. But because of the act in its current format, it's too open to open. It actually creates that loophole for collusion, like I mentioned earlier, that you can actually budget. It's possible even to budget for because you know what your profit's going to be, and you also know what your penalty's going to be. So if one, and that must be seen in view of the penalty regime and also the owning labels, all of those issues form part of the entire regulatory regime and act as a deterrent to stamp out collusive practices. How do we promote the law, promote greater equality? Yes, and I think I'm going to link that question to the Honourable Member here regarding how, if workers are not being co-opted by the new regime. I think first of all that the law will definitely promote the amendments in its current format should it become law, will create greater equality because now, in particular, union will have greater say who represents the workers. So it don't necessarily have to be in terms of shareholding or greater equality, but it must have a focus on jobs and the protection of jobs. If one look at maybe the national interest, so just look at one way, the minister will have the special provision to declare a sector. Let's say if you're under IPEP, clothing, textiles, footwear or furniture, whereby we can purchase school furniture and all those things, then those things are allowed, and that will create greater, not necessarily shareholding, but greater equality in terms of jobs, because those products will be manufactured locally. So I think in that essence, in a broader aspect, the bill will promote the equality, and that's the equality that we are talking about. But in other regimes, if one look at it, it might not be possible. So this will then create that enabling environment. So that not necessarily we're talking about shareholding, and that, but we talk about job creation, we talk about sustainability of jobs and greater economic development. Yes, the issue of co-option, I think there are various ways how one can structure it. I think part of it is that there is need for greater equality and empowerment of workers. You don't have to be necessarily these various options that one can look at, like share option schemes, all those things. So it's not really prescriptive. Description of how it should happen, but I think the law creates, the proposed amendment creates an enabling environment to ensure that greater equality, which we really welcome in this regard. So we believe in essence that I think the bill in its current format will definitely make an impact and create greater equality, inclusivity in society in general. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Benjamin, for the input.
If you'll allow me an observation.
Okay.
I was worried about what we're going to do about the National Union of Leather and Allied Workers. But that is an executive summary of what has just been presented to us by FODUSA, and I just wanted to make that observation, Chair. Thank you.
I think he did indicate that he speaks on behalf of FODUSA and its affiliates, and the National Union of Leather Workers is one of the affiliates.
Yeah. Thank you. Maybe I should just clarify that. Thank you for the observation. I think I'm representing the Federation, but I'm also part of the National Union of Labor and Allied Workers myself. So that's the reason I'm playing a dual role by representing the Federation and the Union itself. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. The time now is 1 minute past two. Let me thank you, Mr. Benjamin, but the process is that the department will respond to all the submissions, oral and written submissions, because there are stakeholders who opted not to come to present orally, but they've sent written submissions. department will respond to all those submissions. And then the committee will deliberate on the submission and the responses of the department, and then deliberate and take a way forward on the bill. Thank you very much for coming in the presentation. Mr. Flock, I'm going to take advantage of you because I know you. I'm going to say, with regard to your presentation, you should do everything from now until 2:30. Presentations and questions and responses. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Good afternoon to the honourable members. Firstly, Chair, just to warn you that during my presentation, some people may enter the room. It's not a BLF coming to carry you away. Some of our shop stewards are on the way, and they're just stuck at the security. So I just want to warn you not to worry. It's not the BLF who's coming in. It's just some of our shop stewards who are coming to observe the proceedings. Chair, I today represent SACTU. SACTU is the SA Clothing and Textile Workers Union. SACTU has 110,000 members, mainly in clothing, textiles, footwear and leather, but also in other related sectors like distribution and laundry and those kinds of things. You know, take into account that our members on average support about 5 family members. We have about 500,000 family coverage for the union. We're an affiliate of the SACTU. And we are here because we have a long history of involvement in competition matters. For us, it's a very, very crucial area. And over the years, you know, since the passing of the Competition Act 20 years ago, we've been involved in dozens of mergers where, you know, in terms of the legislation, where our members are present in a factory or in a workplace that will be part of a merger, we need to be notified of that. And when we are notified of it, we can proceed in terms of these proceedings at the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal, and we can make submissions on the issue of employment. So that's the one area in terms of mergers, but also, Chairperson, in terms of issues around the drafting of the original Act 20 years ago, we were involved in that. In the amendments of the competition legislation, you know, that took place earlier this decade, we were involved in that. So for us, it's a crucial area. Why is it important for us, Chairperson? It's important because our members as workers and with their families as consumers are directly affected by matters of competition in this law, be it directly in terms of working in a factory where there's a merger and then possibly, you know, losing their job or losing employment benefits, or indirectly as consumers in terms of competition that takes place in the market to ensure that, you know, there's fair competition, there isn't collusion, people are not cheated out of prices they may be paying. So that's our interest in this, and this is why you will find many of our shop stewards here today, and ideally, you know, we would have wanted to introduce you to everybody, but to just give you some sense that these are, you know, leaders from SACTU who are in factories across the Western Cape. They've come today here because, you know, for us is a crucial matter. Chair, Comrade Ashley in the presentation before me spoke briefly about the NEDLAC process. We'd like to just share that with you as well and indicate in our view, you know, what is the proceedings there. Firstly, we support the bill. Through COSATU, as an affiliate of COSATU and as part of organized labor, we participated in the NEDLAC process. We came there, we started with a package of demands, and then, you know, to reach agreement at NEDLAC, we had to make certain compromises. It means many of our demands are not included. Some of these demands are included and may have been amended. But the crucial thing, Chairperson, is that the bill is a negotiated outcome, and we respect that. So at the end of the process, we signed off on it, and so we respect that process at NEDLAC. For that reason, we support the bill as it is. in the Cosatu submission, which we've attached, which we were part of drafting and which we've attached to our submission chairperson, we set out in some more detail some of the details of the negotiations at NEDLAC. What was the position of labor? What was the position of business? How ultimately we compromised and ended up, you know, with a agreement that we had. Just briefly, at the conclusion of that process, business and labor agreed the following. It said, the parties at NEDLAC recognized that the process of engagement had been meaningful, substantial, and helpful, and that the bill represents a package of provisions which constitute an appropriate and effective balance of the interests of all the social partners and the policy imperatives of government. So why do we emphasize this? Because it's important for the committee to understand that business was involved in those negotiations as well, and that ultimately business signed off on this package. Chairperson, we think that the further away we move from that NEDLAC agreement, the more business is starting to say, but, you know, we're not quite sure about this, we don't like that anymore, and so on, and yet they signed off on this package. And you know, we, for instance, see the Law Society making representation, yeah, but yet those lawyers led the negotiations on behalf of business at NEDLAC. So we are concerned that, you know, we may be seeing signs of you know, bad faith negotiations. We won't go that far, but, you know, many of our members may well view it in that way. We therefore would like to appeal to the committee to say that, you know, further changes to accommodate large corporate interests will undo what we think is a balanced package negotiated at NEDLAC. So our support for the bill in its current form shouldn't be seen as this is our first choice and we are happy and we've won. This is very much the package which was negotiated after the compromises, and similarly for business, the fact that they will come here and you know, through either themselves or their lawyers, come and raise problems, must be understood that, you know, they were part of this process and very much in agreement to it. Chairperson, in terms of the substance of the bill, we just want to touch on four areas. In our submission and Cosatu submission, we go into great detail in many different areas, but there are four, taking into account the limited time today, that we want to address with you. The first one is economic concentration. The second one, and there's a couple of sub-points there. The second one is the security veto. The third one is the role of executive, and the fourth one is the penalties. Chair, we welcome the bill's focus on addressing the high levels of economic concentration, where these high levels are not justifiable and where the market power is abused. Why are we concerned about concentration? Dominant companies often maximize profit by charging higher prices at the cost of production, employment, and investment. It's associated with higher levels of inequality and narrow ownership structures. So if you had to ask us what is one of the major problems that we have in the South African economy, it's the fact that we have such high economic concentration. It means that there isn't enough opportunity for investment, there isn't enough opportunity for small business, there isn't enough opportunity for innovation, for increased improvements in quality, and for employment ultimately. So we think this bill starts to address this major, major blockage to economic growth and specifically inclusive economic growth. So what is the problem with dominance? It really starts to become a problem where companies start to abuse their dominance. And they do so by dictating prices to suppliers and customers, including black-owned businesses and small businesses. And this, as we said, has negative consequences for economic growth, for inequality, and for transformation. Chairperson, to get into a little bit more detail around price discrimination, we welcome the amendments to Section 9 of the Act proposed by the bill. We think it will help to address complaints from large businesses, from small businesses, and from black-owned businesses that are victims of price discrimination and where their ability to participate in the market is impeded. SACTU supports moving the evidentiary burden to dominant firms to show price discrimination against small businesses and black-owned firms was not anti-competitive, and making the test to prove price discrimination easier. Chairperson, why have we not seen more cases on price discrimination? Why have we not seen a raft of successful cases on price discrimination at the competition authorities. It's because it's been very difficult to prove until now. And we think that the bill does a couple of things. Firstly, it makes it easier to set out a case. But secondly, it moves the evidentiary burden to big businesses to say, once a prima facie case has been made by the Competition Commission, big business must then indicate that it is not unfairly discriminating against these small businesses. Without this, the strengthening of the price discrimination feature of the law, it would be very difficult to prove prohibited price discrimination, and such practices would only continue, which is what we've seen up until now, with especially smaller businesses being the victims of these practices. Chair, the next section we'd like to talk about is what's referred to as the kind of buyer power or dominant customer provisions. We welcome the amendments to Section 8.4. Previously, it was in Section 8.1 as well, but following the discussions at the Portfolio Committee, it's been included in Section 8.4. We think this is a very important new provision introduced into the law. Why do we say this? Many sectors have either monopsonies or oligopsonies, where there are only one or a few buyers of certain products. So we are often very accustomed with the idea of monopolies, but we also have the problem of monopsonies in South Africa. And this is where there are only a few buyers, and all the power then rests with those buyers, and they can dictate prices to the suppliers. This amendment will prohibit a dominant firm to require a supplier, which is a small business or a black-owned business, to sell its product at a price or on terms which impedes the supplier to participate effectively. Chairperson, many of the businesses where many of the worker leaders here come from are the ones who are the victims of these practices. So, for instance, if you look at the South African clothing retail space, only six very dominant players. And you know, whichever mall you go into, you know, wherever you move in South Africa, these players dominate. It means that when you are a small or medium-sized clothing manufacturing business, you have to negotiate with these very powerful businesses. They often push prices down to the point where there's no way you can survive, where there's no way you can be sustainable. Why are we worried about it? It means our members lose their jobs. It means we are unable to have strong businesses. It means we are unable to have a strong manufacturing industry. It means all the power rests with retailers. And, Chair, that's very obvious once you start to look at the profits. Where do the profits lie in the clothing, textile, footwear, leather, and retail value chain? It lies with retail. Very little profits in clothing manufacturing and footwear manufacturing. And this is because of the very, very uneven distribution of power and the abuse of that power, where they dictate prices to small businesses, meaning those small businesses often are not sustainable. Chair, so one of the concerns that we've heard is, you know, well, how will you deal with a specific section? You know, you've indicated the idea of a fair price, but what is the definition of fair? You know, firstly, we think it's contained in other legislation, and Chairperson, this committee will know it well, because it's often in labor laws, where we talk about unfair discrimination, for instance, but it's also something that's found in other competition jurisdictions. So for us, this is you know, kind of asking what's the definition is really a red herring, because there are ways to deal with it. Then the question is, well, you know, what does it mean to treat customers unfairly? And we think, you know, there are some very obvious examples. You know, when a dominant customer decides to give other big business or to give other businesses, you know, pay them a higher price, but to squeeze smaller businesses for a much lower price, then obviously there's some unfair discrimination there that we believe is not fair, because if they are able to pay those higher prices to bigger businesses, they should do the same to smaller businesses. But, Chairperson, it's not just about price, it's also about terms. Because often it may be that a bigger business, you know, will be paid within 30 days. But a smaller business, because they are less powerful, will be dictated to that they will only be paid in 60 or 90 days. And if their customer can pay others in 30 days, why must the smaller business suffer? We can just ignore it, but it's at the risk of never ever opening our market for small, opening our economy for smaller firms and medium-sized firms. It means that, you know, we will always be stuck with this concentration. It means that the concentration that we're seeing will stop the economic growth that we're looking for in this country and will stop the job creation that we're looking for. But even, you know, having said all of that, our understanding is that the minister will publish regulations around this, where parties who would want to give input can give comment on it and can indicate, you know, how they think the regulations should be amended or drafted. Chairperson, moving away from economic concentration, the next section we'd like to talk about is one that, you know, you will have heard about often, both in the media but also, you know, in the public hearings and in the submissions. It's on the security veto. At the moment, there's no provision in law in South Africa for government to deal with certain very worrying scenarios. For instance, if a firm owned by a hostile government buys a strategic South African firm, there's no way for the government to stop that. If an international firm buys a local private security firm and in effect ends up with a big private army in South Africa, there's no provision in law for government to stop it. Yet government has a responsibility to do so, has a responsibility to protect its citizens and to look out for these matters, but there's no provision. So we welcome the inclusion of this provision in the law. Comrade Ashley had indicated that there are several other examples of these provisions in other jurisdictions. We wanted to say to you that the security veto was not Labour's first choice. We think this is a compromised position because originally when we went to NEDLAC, we said that what should also be covered is there should be an executive veto for public interest matters. So in other words, when a very large international firm starts to buy South African assets and there may be a negative impact on South African industry, or South African small businesses or South African jobs, government should also have a veto. So we had wanted it expanded. We negotiated this at NEDLAC, and ultimately we ended up with what we think is a kind of a watered-down proposal and a compromise. But what we've accepted in terms of the negotiation and in terms of the package. So you will hear many people complain and say, well, this is a problematic area. But for us, it's not our first choice. We wanted this to be much, much wider than what it is. And ultimately, this compromised position of a security veto in the way that it's set out in the law is what came out of NEDLAC. On the security issue, some of the questions is it overly burdensome? We don't think so. We think it provides certainty for investors, as there are steps now set out in law and in regulations. There will be in regulations which set out exactly how this will be dealt with. And in addition, there's a 60 days limit. So there isn't even an open-ended discussion and consideration of these international mergers. There's a kind of a very narrow period and a narrow set of factors that should be considered. Now, the question is, are the factors to determine the industries to which this applies too broad? We don't think so. In our discussions, we understand that they are significantly, you know, that this is very much in line with other countries, and specifically example that's been cited is Canada. So from SACTU's side, Chairperson, we think this is a very welcome intervention, even though it's ultimately watered down from what we had initially wanted. Chair, the second last area to discuss is on the role of the executive. We support the increased role for the executive, including strengthening the provisions relating to the right of the executive to participate in mergers. And this is specifically Section 17(1)(c). I'm not going to read that now, but we like the fact that there is now clarity in terms of how the executive can participate. We also welcome the increased role for the executive in terms of publishing regulations, including in Sections 4, 5, 8, and others. Why do we think it's important that the executive play an active role here? It's because the executive has to promote public policy goals. Ultimately, it's the executive that was elected on a platform and on a campaign which it sets out its particular interests and its priorities in terms of governing. And for that reason, we think it needs to take responsibility. Our members expect the policymakers, who they keep responsible at the ballot box and through Parliament, to be responsible for mergers policy, to play an active role in mergers, especially where jobs, factory sectors, and small businesses are at risk, and to represent workers and other public interests. Chairperson, finally, on penalties, and once again, Comrade Ashley had mentioned some of this earlier. We support the amendments to Section 59 to strengthen the penalty regime. Initially, we had proposed a wider set of penalties. We wanted some more penalties. You know, wanted the admin penalties to be strengthened, and we proposed higher penalties for first offences. But ultimately, you know, there's a package that was agreed on. Why are we so concerned about penalties? Because cartels and collusion and other prohibited practice, Chairperson, is not a minor infringement without victims. It's not as if it's something that just affects a boardroom or the profits of a company or the profits of their competitors. Ultimately, it affects the workers and the poor, either directly or indirectly. So how does it affect them directly? The bread cartel is a good example. You know, if a whole lot of companies collude to push up the price of bread, it means that our members and other workers, the working class, pay more for that bread, so it affects them directly. How does it affect them indirectly? Once again, the construction cartel is a good example, where suddenly the fiscus had to pay more money than what it should have for these soccer stadiums. What could have happened? They could have used that money either for grants or for other infrastructure. So it affects our members indirectly. So for us, you know, this is a crucial, crucial matter. It's necessary to strengthen the penalty regime because the authorities continue to uncover more collusion every couple of months. We hear of new cartels. We think the current regime does not act as a sufficient deterrent. We welcome the increase in the penalty for a repeat offence to a maximum of 25% of a company's turnover and the provision to extend penalties to the turnover of parent firms in specified circumstances. We believe we are not an outlier of penalties, and we give the example of the EU here. Finally, in terms of the penalties and specifically the yellow card provision, Chairperson, we think it's time for the yellow card to get a red card. It's finished. We can't continue to have this yellow card. It means that the companies, what does the yellow card provision mean? It means that companies have to be found guilty twice of certain prohibited practices that are not listed in the Act before they are penalized. There's no other major jurisdiction with this yellow card. Other laws do not have a yellow card. Imagine if we have laws in other yellow cards in other laws. We had to be found guilty twice of a certain prohibited practice. But there's another kind of a hidden part of the yellow card, and that's where authorities do investigations, take their time, go through the entire process, and at the end, when a company is found guilty, there's absolutely, you know, no real impact, because they can't impose a penalty and the prohibited practice goes unpunished. We think that after 20 years of the Competition Act, companies understand this, know what they can't do, and should take extra care, and it's time to remove this provision. Chairperson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I think we're still within time. Members, any questions? Honorable Makuwe, Honorable Ntebe. Let me also welcome Sir Stuart that is just joined. We know it's always been a tradition that when we are in the process of lawmaking, we always come in numbers. We've been in the plenary. We appreciated that when we are passing the labor laws, you were there in the gallery. So we appreciate and encourage other stakeholders also to come when we finally table the report, not only workers but also other sectors. We encourage them so that they not just come to present but they must also follow these law processes, making these lawmaking processes to its final conclusion. Yeah. Thank you very much, Honorable Makube.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We welcome the presentation. Just an opening remark, Chair, that I will not apologize that my mother was a garment worker and my mother-in-law was a garment worker as well. So I appreciate very much when I see the people from this province and know how difficult it is within that sector of the economy at the moment, and therefore that adds to how one listens to the presentation that has been made by Sabtu to us. We welcome that. Just three quick questions, Chair, and I'll be quick. My first is on the six dominant players that you mentioned. If you can share it with us in the open forum, it would help. I don't see why you shouldn't, but just for us to have that. My second question is related thereto. In your exchange in NEDLAC with business is not engaging with us as we had wished for as Parliament, but could you help, without speculating, to say to us, those that are not coming to us, what would you as a trade unionist understand to be some of the reasons why they're not here? My final question would be, Chair, that you indicate that you have made presentations to the Portfolio Committee and you also participated in the public hearings. Other than the yellow card matter that you're raising with us now, would there be changes that you particularly want to draw our attention to that you have not raised in the previous presentations? And then the B part of that question is just going to be on the yellow card, Chair, that it doesn't help us as a select committee if you say two yellow cards is not sufficient. We are not the referees yet until the bill is put up. So while we're busy with that legislation, are you happy that we leave it as it is at the moment, the yellow card scenario, or is there something much more substantive that you want to propose to us? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. It's true that SACTU has a very rich history of participating actively in a process of lawmaking, particularly in the competition issues that are rising for the legislation. One, there's been an issue that fairness or unfairness is a contested terrain. So now that you know, you are well aware of the competition that is existing in the lawmaking here, and there's a higher possibility of litigation going forward, would you concede that the fairness and the unfairness is very subjective and therefore can be contested by anybody? If not, are you sticking by the presentation that you have just made to say fairness has been adequately covered by either in relation to other laws, and you refer to law, labor laws, or jurisprudence that as it exists? Secondly, are you saying lawyers were representing businesses in the process of consultation at NEDLAC? If yes, what do you make of their submission in the committee? Do you think it's objective? Do you think how somehow subjective? And what do you make of it? I think the last one, Chair, would be the issue of the consequence management. Do you think that you are sufficiently covered with the object of the bill as it stands, or you would want us to see what more can be done? Like you're saying, as an example, you said probably we need to go past the process of yellow cards and go to the red cards. But there's also a view from the other sectors who are participants in this process who are saying, in whatever manifestations, we should be wary not to chase away foreign direct investments. And there seems to be that concession from the other side that says foreign direct investment is critical in the country and therefore it must be protected, and rigid labor regulations framework are depleting that. What is your view? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Makue and Honourable Nteve. Honourable Makue, we should probably make you honorary shop steward then with your rich history in the industry. You asked what are the six dominant players? It's the six large listed clothing retailers, which is Pepkor, who's changed its name from Stein of African Retail recently. It's Edcon, which is the holding company for Edgars and Jet. It's Truworths, it's Foschini, it's Woolworths, and it's Mr. Price. So those are the major clothing retailers where an enormous amount of power and profit in our particular value chain lies. So it's Pepkor, Mr. Price, Edcon, Foschini, Woolworths, and Truworths. So you then asked to indicate why we think business is not yet. You will I trust recognize that this is speculation on our side, that we don't know the exact reason, but we believe partly they're in a difficult situation because at NEDLAC they've agreed to a package of proposals. And if they were seen to explicitly come and sit here and support it, they I don't know, maybe difficult for them. So it may be that they in a between a rock and a hard place. So the question we have is, are many of their proxies that are coming here, are they acting on the behalf of big business? Are they coming to make presentations on behalf of those businesses because those business associations don't want to do so themselves. In terms of the yellow card, Honourable Makue, we in the kind of final part of the presentation, we indicated that we think that that it's time that the yellow card provision comes to an end, and we support the way that the bill is doing that. So we wouldn't want any changes to the bill. We think that the way the yellow card provision is being stopped, but with some safeguards that I must say was introduced at NEDLAC following some objections from business, where they indicated yes, but there could still be some uncertainty and so on. There were some compromises made on the part of both labor and government to accommodate business. So we support the way it's currently set out in the bill for the yellow card provision to be ended, but and support the way that there are still some, a little bit of flexibility left to assist those businesses. So we would not want to change, and similarly, I think answers Honourable Ntebe's question. We would not want to change at all. So Honourable Ntebe said, fairness or fair or unfair may be contested, and it could be subjective. We, as indicated Honourable Ntebe in our presentation, we think that if it's going to be contested, if it's going to be raised, there are certain safeguards that are built into the bill. For instance, the fact that regulations will be published, where whoever has concerns about it can comment on those regulations to ensure that it's changed in a way which they think would be better. We think that while it may not be defined in the Act, there's sufficient for the Competition Tribunal, the Competition Appeal Court, there's sufficient other areas of law, including the labor law that we mentioned, that the word fair is used. So we think it does provide for, you know, a good way of moving forward, and that we think that, you know, even though it may be contested, there's sufficient safeguards and sufficient certainty in other parts of law. You asked about the lawyers representing business. So at NEDLAC, we had both representatives from the business associations, representatives from many large businesses, but also representatives from some of the major law firms who attended. And so you know, it's a difficult question for us, you know, because, you know, are the lawyers representing themselves at these negotiations, or are they representing Sasol, MTN, etc.? You know, are they you know, coming there to make proposals on what they think is best in terms of law, or what they think is best in terms of their clients who may be involved in cartels or collusion? So you are right. I mean, the question about it's a good question is, you know, are they objective or subjective? You asked about the consequence management and the object of the bill. What more can be done? You know, for us, it's important that this bill be implemented. You know, we've gone through an extensive process. Comrade Ashley described it at NEDLAC. Went through an extensive process. Excuse me, where we negotiated this, and you know, once again, as indicated earlier, for COSATU, for FIDUSA, for NACTU, who is also part of the caucus, for its affiliates, you know, everything that's in here is not our first choice. But for us now, it's important, as with the National Minimum Wage Bill when it came here, for it to be finalized now and implemented. You know, we sit with a recession. We sit with, you know, unemployment that's close to 28%. And the way to deal with it is to implement this bill and start to deal with the concentration, the monopolies, and the continued collusion that we're seeing. So for us, you know, our appeal would be, even though everything is not our first choice, our appeal would be to finalize this legislation as quickly as possible. Honourable Ntebe, you raised the issue of the foreign direct investment, and that, you know, is often, you know, kind of the kind of scare tactics used by many to say, but what about the foreign direct investors? You know, are they not going to be scared off by this? But what would any you know, interested foreign investor would look at South Africa and say, what is the chance of me, you know, firstly of the country, you know, being growing, of the country, you know, seeing less inequality, the country seeing less poverty in a few years' time. And the current trajectory would not give them comfort that we will see that. So we need to change the current trajectory. We need to introduce a new way of dealing with it. And if you are a foreign business and you see a lot of concentration in the South African economy, as the World Bank chairperson has indicated there is, then you're probably worried about, will you be able to make money in that economy? And whereas, you know, if there's less concentration, if there's less inequality, if there's less poverty, there's a much better chance of you setting up a business which will grow and be profitable in the future. One of the major obstacles to growth in South Africa is inequality. And it's not just inequality between white and black and inequality between rich and poor, but inequality in terms of, you know, major businesses hogging all the profits and smaller businesses not being able to do so. So we think it's totally wrong to say that foreign direct investment will not happen as a result of this bill. In actual fact, there's most probably guaranteed that there'll be increased foreign direct investment if we implement this well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flock, on behalf of SACTU, for the presentation. And you were here when I was outlining the process, so I won't repeat the process going forward, other than to thank you for coming, and also thank members of SACTU for also coming to observe. We also acknowledge the statement from inside the country, India, Matthew?
Yes.
Yeah, from India. seen him in Parliament the past week. Moving around, attending all these committees to see how South African Parliament works. We appreciate that. Welcome. The next presentation is from Helen Suzman Foundation. The two of you. The gentleman is from...
Sorry, Chair, just to be clear, I had a slight problem with my scheduling. I was supposed to speak this morning at just past 12. The email amending the schedule was actually sent to a colleague of mine. He only noticed at 1. So I arrived for the session as per usual. I was wondering to if you could maybe reschedule me, if that would be possible. No, not necessarily first, but just sometime this afternoon, if possible.
The two of you now...
Oh no, I'm unrelated to them. That's for Helen Susan Foundation. I'm here from Sakalicha.
Is that with Helen?
Yes.
Yep.
That's perfect. Yes.
You have to come here.
You're welcome to stay on SAC2 and listen to other presenters. They've been listening to you. But whenever you feel like you want to go, you can. Okay. Otherwise, you're welcome to stay on. Thank you. You just introduce yourself and continue the presentation. The process is that I'm sure you have observed. That after the presentation, we allow members to ask questions, and then you respond to the question, and then I'll ask you on the process going forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee for welcoming us here today. My name is Kimera Chetty. I'm accompanied by my colleague, Mira Brill. We're from the Helen Suzman Foundation. We're an NGO that's focused on the promotion of constitutional democracy and the rule of law. Chair, this is our second appearance presenting on this bill. We've made written submission before to the Portfolio Committee, as well as attending the public hearing at the Portfolio Committee public hearing stage. We are back again with essentially the same submission, Chair, regrettably, because none of our recommendations on the first iteration have found its way into this new iteration of the bill. In fact, there have been more amendments, and so we'll flag for the select committee where those further amendments have been commented on in our submission. But to a large extent, this is very much the same concerns that were raised at the portfolio committee stage. To that extent, this submission by the Helen Suzman Foundation focuses purely on one section of the competition amendment bill. Insofar as it relates to our interest in the bill and where we think we can add some perhaps useful input, and that's section 18A of the bill, which relates to the national security veto laid out in the bill. The first thing we'd like to say, Chair, is that the HSF endorses the objectives of the bill, and those are the broad objectives of addressing high levels of concentration and the skewed ownership profile of the economy. We also encourage that where the administrative efficiency of the commission and the tribunal can be promoted, we support that. Insofar as we're dealing with national security, we do recognize that the constitutional imperative found in Section 198 of the Constitution sets out governing principles of national security, and we further recognize that national security is subject to the authority of both Parliament and the national executive, so that's not in contention. What we highlight as a concern in this submission is whether or not it's appropriate to locate that kind of decision-making focus on national security interests within the competition law regime. And so I want to make it clear, because I think at our last presentation, that point was lost in the discourse. We, you know, have two recent events where we can at least point out to where this tension for us is confusing, because, you know, we've read the minister's budget vote speech for 2018-2019. We've seen the comments made by the president at the recent investment summit. All indicators tell us that at the very high level of both the department and the office of the presidency, South Africa is open for business, particularly to encourage foreign direct investment as well as create a climate that makes it attractive for businesses to come and do business in South Africa. And that's the rhetoric we're getting from those two high-level offices. What we find confusing is just this dichotomy that's being presented to us is that you can't do both, that you can't encourage foreign direct investment without also promoting and protecting the local economy. We think that's false. We've seen, particularly in Minister Patel's budget speech vote, that budget vote speech is precisely what the department has been doing. It's been the key negotiator in looking to protect and promote local industries and local players and support the local economy while also being able to encourage and make South Africa an attractive investment location. So insofar as we think that narrative is, and we've seen it come up again, that you have to have one at the expense of the other, we don't think that's true. And we think clearly from the department's own role in the country that that's something that the department is invested in putting forward. Going then, Chair, into the substance of our submission. We assume the committee has also gone through our submission, so you're familiar with the content, and I won't read the whole thing out to you. But Section C of our submission is a diagram that sets out basically a reasonable interpretation of the process as we understand it, as laid out by the bill. We've made the disclaimer before in the previous presentation is that insofar as we're wrong or mistaken about this process, we're happy to accept that we might be wrong or mistaken, but we think that what that points to then is the potential for uncertainty in how the process is laid out that arises from the drafting of the provisions in the bill. And so, you know, this the way we've laid out, if you look at the diagram, the first half can kind of be understood as the interaction between all relevant stakeholders or actors, and that's from the Office of the Presidency in regulating the national security interests all the way down to the merging parties. And the second half of that diagram looks at then the outcome and recourse. Our main concern, as you will pick up in our submission, is located in that second part, is when the outcome of a decision is made, what kind of mechanisms for recourse are available, and how do parties engaged in this interaction with the committee or the commission or the tribunal or the courts know how to navigate their right to recourse, either through appeal or review or whatever. And so that's the process as we understood it, and you know, insofar as we are mistaken in how things will work, we're happy to be set on the right path, but we think that a lot of these uncertainties just arise out of the way provisions are drafted. When we say the way provisions are drafted, we're specifically referring to broadness and vagueness. Why we point to the in the substance of our submission, why broadness and vagueness are particularly, you know, worrying legislative deficiencies is because they create room for uncertainty, potential abuses of power, and those are obvious bad things. Going then, Chair, to Section D of our submission, we talk about this appropriateness of locating Section 18A in the Competition Act. We start off by saying that South Africa does not have currently an integrated national security policy. What we're finding in this Act is the pursuance of a national security strategy. There's, for many reasons, a worrying, a concern when you pursue strategy in the absence of policy. When we say a national security policy, it's just an important point of consensus for us. So, you know, these examples then that we lay out, because we do a comparative for, as we did for the Portfolio Committee and we do for this committee, of how the United States, Australia, and Canada deal with this exact same provision. It's been brought up in previous presentations, again, that this exists in other regimes. But you know, these examples merely evidence regimes that have significant experience in navigating such a provision. to our mind, what they do is provide useful lessons, both in their successes and their mistakes. Why we worry more about the mistakes for South Africa is because where these provisions are mainly dominant are in developed economies who can potentially shoulder or manage more of those mistakes when they lead to disinvestment or a poor economic outcome. South Africa as a developing economy obviously will have to shoulder a bigger burden where this might, through its uncertainty, encourage disinvestment. We particularly want to highlight Canada as an example because it was raised. And I'll read out the process that the Canadian model follows there. So Canada enacted the Investment Canada Act, which is administered by the Investment Review Division, which is a government department. That government department sits in the Ministry of Innovation, Science, and Economic Development. The Investment Review Division works together with the minister of that division, the Minister of Public Safety, and the Minister of Emergency Preparedness. Whereafter, the proposed investment is referred to Cabinet, Cabinet being the Prime Minister and appointed ministers, who may order a formal review to test for adverse national security risks. We think that's important. So this Cabinet-ordered review process is then an investigative process which involves another body called Public Safety Canada, which is the Security and Intelligence Agency of Canada, other investigative bodies, as set out in the National Security Review in the investment regulations, are also involved. So the Investment Canada Act basically is a piece of legislation that specifically deals with these kinds of mergers where a potential adverse national security risk might arise in a foreign acquiring party coming into the country to acquire a target firm that is local. We point to this just to highlight the degree to which seniority and expertise is a priority in making these kinds of determinations. And so it's not to say that, oh, other countries do it, so it's not a problem. In how other countries done it and the seriousness with which they treat national security as a homeland security risk, a threat to the domestic economy, the protection of its own people, we recognize and we support. But we think insofar as it appears in this act, the Competition Act, it's confusing, and we'll go through in the legislative decision seat why we think more attention needs to be paid and not a throwaway line about the creation of a committee to deal with these very serious considerations. That's found in point two of our submission, which talks about then the definitional issues. What this section does is that it introduces the creation of a new body, this committee that President Ramaphosa or the incumbent president sitting will create to basically make this determination. However, that committee doesn't find a definition either in the first iteration of the bill or the second iteration. We think that insofar as you're going to refer to a body, for clarity and for sake of certainty, it needs a definition. We propose then that definition means the Standing Committee as constituted by the President of the Republic, tasked with determining the national security threat or interest occasioned by a merger involving a foreign acquiring firm. You'll notice that we specifically use the word standing. A Standing Committee, insofar that we might be mistaken about what Standing Committee implies, we're happy for that wording to be changed, but as long as it indicates a committee that's consistent and not an ad hoc committee. Our justification for that is that a permanent committee or permanent sitting committee is more valuable insofar as it ensures consistency in the way decisions are made. It will enable the committee to establish a streamlined administrative process of notification and correspondence. And also, it's not hamstrung by expertise or experience because Section 18A9 allows for this committee to consult with outside experts and the commission. And so it's not constrained by the inability to consult. It can still consult outside of its own composition. But we make a further concern there, Chair, that in Section 18A2, the way that the bill is drafted is that it essentially allows the President to appoint cabinet members as well as other public officials. And these other public officials are not, there's no clarity about from which office or rank they'll be drawn from to make essentially a high-level determination that affects the national economic interests of the country. So our suggestion there, and you'll find it on page 6 at the top of our submission, is that we've made specific recommendations of which high-ranking officials we think should be appointed to this committee. And those are officials from economic development, trade and industry, state security, national intelligence, treasury, and policing. These are merely suggestive, Chair. Nothing in the submission, you know, insofar as we are making suggestions is prescriptive, but insofar as we make suggestions, it's to help the process of how this committee is composed, who will sit, and insofar as the exercise of public power is being carried out. The other definitions that we make are two more. The one is, who is a foreign acquiring firm? In the current definition, there is the wording of effective management. However, there's no definition of what effective management is, because insofar as you're saying a foreign acquiring firm is a firm whose place of effective management is outside the Republic, that needs to be clarified. Our suggestion of how effective management could be defined, we leave it to the committee to make that decision or the drafters, but insofar as we can point out that it's undefined, we think it's a problem. Target firm as well, Chair, is undefined. We think that what might be a useful suggestion would be to say the president must constitute a committee which must be responsible for considering terms of this section. Whether the implementation of a merger involving a foreign acquiring firm and a South African target firm, being a firm which carries out its business in South Africa, may have an adverse effect on the national security interests of the Republic. So we specifically identify target firm as being a South African firm to avoid foreign-to-foreign transactions which might at least create uncertainty for the merging parties insofar as target firm is undefined. So the next two pages, page 6 and 7, which deal with the appeal and review mechanisms, I think are self-explanatory. If we can point to possibly one of our biggest concerns coming through from the portfolio committee to this stage is that we don't think an appeal or review mechanism for the decision, for challenging a decision made by any public body, is contentious. And so we think it's what this leads to is just opening the bill up when it's passed for potential legal challenge by merging parties, which is a costly and ineffective process in and of itself, which could be easily remedied just with the inclusion of some mechanistic detail in the legislation of what do you do when you want to challenge a decision, which is the appropriate forum to challenge a decision. Is it the commission? Is it the committee? Is there an internal or external review process that parties can point to? None of that is clear. None of that exists in the current legislation. And so that's where our concern there lies, as well as in the pre-decision engagement process, which is absent in the bill. So there's no, you know, the bill talks about conditions set by the committee, or the section, sorry, talks about it, but there's no indication of how parties can engage prior to either assuage some of the concerns that the committee might have. And I'll hand over, Chair, to my colleague Mira to continue the discussion.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm going to address the last four sections of our submission. I'm going to try to be quick because I see we're running out of time. So firstly, something else we identified is that in subsection 4, section 18A, the factors that are there from which the president is going to make gazette a list of national security interests, on our reading, they seem very broad and vague. And our concern about this is that it doesn't actually aid the president in distilling a defined list of national security interests. And so rather, we suggest that a narrower, more limited set of factors be adopted in the bill amended and put in the bill. And a good example of this limited set of factors appears in the Promotion of Access to Information Act in section 41.2. So if the committee were going to consider an amendment of this sort, that is a helpful precedent to consider. And then on page 9 of our submission, we identify an inconsistency between section 18A, subsection 6, and subsection 11. I'm not going to read that out now because, again, I think that that is self-explanatory, but if you could just consider that. In terms of those two sections as well, the more concerning inconsistency is the sequence of events and how the process is to run. So in terms of subsection six, it states that the notification of the committee and the competition commission must occur at the same time. But then in subsection 18A, subsection 11 of 18A, it makes it clear that the committee must be notified prior to the commission. So I think just clarity, I'm not sure if this was intentional or if it was a drafting error, but clarity in terms of this would certainly help the smoothness of the process. And then we actually propose the adoption of an approach which would certainly have to involve redrafting aspects of this section, but we think it will enhance the certainty and clarity. As it stands, the onus is on the foreign acquiring firm to notify the committee when they have identified that the merger will relate to these national security interests. This position assumes that the foreign acquiring firm is able to honestly identify whether the merger concerns the national security interests, and it also assumes that if the foreign acquiring firm fails to notify the committee, they have done so in bad faith, deserving of a penalty. So the alternative we propose is actually to shift the onus onto the Competition Commission. So how we envision the process to look is that a foreign acquiring firm who wants to merge with a South African firm, and let's say they're above the threshold of a large merger, they must notify the Competition Commission in terms of Section 13A of the Act, and then upon filing this notification, the Competition Commission will flag this merger as one involving a foreign acquiring firm, and they will determine, based on the list of national security interests published by the President, whether this merger relates to the list of national security interests. If it does relate to this list, then all they will do is they will refer the merger for consideration by the committee, which is established in terms of Section 18A, and the committee, as per this section, will then make the determination. So it's not taking any power or discretion away from the committee. It just provides two benefits, two apparent benefits to us, which is firstly that there then only needs to be one point of initial contact for the foreign acquiring firm, which saves costs in terms of establishing and running the administrative affairs of this committee that's established in terms of the section. So without having to accommodate a notification process, the committee will have far less of an administrative burden. And then the second benefit that we identify is that the Commission may be better placed to understand whether there are issues of national security, and it makes more sense to us to rely on their competencies and expertise to notify the committee of an intended merger rather than relying on a foreign acquiring firm to identify this. So again, we just think that this approach will enhance certainty, which, as we know, encourages investment. Then we have carried through an additional suggestion from our submission made to the Portfolio Committee, and that relates to Section 18A, Subsection 15. Our concern there is that this bill goes to great lengths to mandate the President and to delegate him certain functions, and we think that it would be... it's unnecessary and, in fact, inappropriate to allow those duties and functions to be delegated to Cabinet members. And so our suggestion made to the Portfolio Committee, and we again affirm the suggestion, is that Subsection 15 doesn't need to be there, and it can, in fact, be repealed because this is the President's prerogative and it should stay that way. So our final point is just, again, it's about balancing the interests of national security against the protection of an open investment policy. As my colleague has demonstrated, we can recognize the importance of protecting national security, but we also cannot lose sight of the benefit or the economic benefit of foreign investment. And to make this point very clear, we recommend two more amendments that could be included in the preamble of the Act and then after Section 18A, Subsection 9 of the Act. I'm not going to bore you with the details of those, but I believe you can read them in Section 8 of our submission, on point 8. I think, in conclusion, if I can I mean, we pose several scenarios to try to work out how this bill will operate in real life, or this section will operate in real life. And we could think of some instances of a merger where there were certainly national security risks, and that would be, for instance, a foreign acquiring firm going and trying to acquire Danel, for example, which, of course, that would raise immediate flags, and that type of merger should be scrutinized, or there should be executive intervention as prescribed by Section 18A. But then we could also imagine mergers where there may be a good faith foreign acquiring firm who's responding to South Africa's investment drive, and they want to merge, and they don't identify themselves as posing any risk to national security, and as a consequence, they don't notify this committee, they just notify the commission. If for some reason the commission allows the merger without flagging the fact that this merger should have gone to the committee, the merger will occur, and years down the line, it may be the case that this foreign acquiring firm then gets penalized for not having notified the committee years prior to that. And this is just concerning because it really, punishing a good faith merger disincentivizes investment. We realize that those scenarios are based on our reasonable interpretation of this bill, but they're also based on several unknowns. For example, what exactly is this list that the president is going to gazette? What factors will it contain? They may be really narrow, in which case this may not be a concern, but they could be very broad, in which case our scenarios may actually come to fruition. And so it is possible that there are higher up stakeholders in this bill who have envisioned safeguards, and it is possible even that this committee is aware of additional safeguards that may be regulated after the enactment of this bill. But we are not aware of those, and that is concerning because I think it really does give the perception, or it could give the perception, that this Section 18A inquiry is intended to be a deterrent to investment, and it may turn people away or investors away. So Our interest here today is in the integrity and independence of South African institutions. We are making these suggestions to increase the certainty and minimize the punitive measures and to ensure that we do not disincentivize honest and good foreign investment and positive engagements with South African authorities and South African players. So I think that is all, and I'm happy to elaborate on anything I've said and any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, any questions? Honorable Mabuwe, Honorable Chairman, that order.
Chairperson, to thank the Alan Sussman Foundation for the presentation, and although they've indicated that they will point us to things that are new, I didn't pick them up. And I want to say, Chair, that as members of this Parliament, we do take any presentation that is made to us seriously. And we appreciate the differences of opinion that is being expressed in the presentations as well. Our democracy is maturing quite rapidly, and we want you to understand that if nothing that you have said is contained in the bill that is before us now, it doesn't mean that what you've said is not important, because we keep these things on record. Now, what is happening as well is that we are members of Parliament, we aren't lawyers. But what we have is we have lawyers helping us. And there's one here, but then also before the legislation is presented to us as members of Parliament, it's given to our parliamentary legal advisors, and they look at that. And therefore, the concerns that you're raising does not go down the drain. We take what you've presented to us, and the chairperson will tell you this better, that we take it to our legal advisors and say, yes, your presentation that they have made What do you think of it? Now, to just give you two examples, Chair. The one is that in your concluding remarks in the package that you've given to us, the last sentence says, our proposals for review and interaction will improve the rationality of the committee's decisions. Now, I can become angry and say, are you saying that we are irrational and you will improve? We're not going to go there and have that debate because we've had it all the time that we're going to say, but use the word may. It doesn't register the point. The point that you're trying to make is to say that we must be rational. Is that it? That's my first. My second one, Chair, is just to say that please, Helen Sussman Foundation delegates, also understand that we are participating in international fora. An example thereof is the International Parliamentary Union, where our deputy chairperson of the NCOP, Radhi Rasareti Tau, is the chairperson of the IPU Commission on Peace and Security, where the biggest forum of parliamentarians get together. And we do hear what is happening at that level and take it into consideration when we look at the draft bill that is before us. Also, to just say that when you look at Section 189 of the Constitution, look at Section 189. Section 198, that's why it doesn't, because I knew it had two of the same numbers. When you look at 198, also look at 199. And you may want to say that maybe it's important for us to look at an amendment to that clause in the Constitution and not look at bringing things into legislation that is covered indeed by the Constitution. So you can decide whether you would want us to do that. Just my final point then, Chair, is to say that unfortunately the example that you're giving to us, United States, Canada, and Australia, are not the best examples. United States is taking such a protectionist position on trade that we cannot side with them. When you mention Canada, you're saying the definition of a citizen of Canada. There's no such thing as a citizen of Canada. All of them have chased out the original people of Canada, which are Canadian Indians. And they have killed them because they wanted to do trade in that country. And what this bill is trying to do is to say that when we do trade, it must be fair, it must be respectful of the rights of the citizens of our country. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
You said in your presentation, as you were about to conclude, that your intention is to minimize punitive measures and incentivize good faith investors. What is your take on the skewed pattern of accumulation, distribution, and accumulation in the economy as it stands, which contributes to inequality, which contributes to unemployment sitting at 27.2%. If you go to your page 4, you're saying you want to pursue, you don't agree that we should pursue national security in the arena of competitive law. But you are saying to us, we must agree that in this amendment bill, we must have a clause that says Section 8A must be taken off and the committee must be set up. So you want to give effect of the committee that is not catered for in the competitive law, through competitive law. Is it possible? The third paragraph in your first page, you speak about national security subject is the subject of authority of Parliament and the Executive. Are you not comforted by the fact that Parliament in its wisdom can pass a law that speaks to national security? Thank you, Chair.
I have responses, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the questions. On the first question, it's more a point of clarity. That last paragraph in our submission, when we refer to the committee, does not refer to this committee. The committee we refer to is the committee in the bill. Rationality is used as a legal term. There's a precedent for that in our jurisprudence about how to test for rationality in decision-making. So when we say we'll improve the rationality of the committee's decisions, we mean that as a legal concept, and we mean that as the committee referred to, as the committee set up by President Ramaphosa. I think there was some misunderstanding there. On the second point about the examples that there's two parts to that point. The first is that the comment was that, you know, this committee and members of this committee sit on higher level panels. They engage in higher level discussions. We appreciate all of that. And that was precisely our point in the submission, is that a lot of the things that might be happening behind the scenes that are creating safeguards and that are within that higher level elite conversation that is not coming down or filtering down to the broader public and certainly might not be coming down to potential investors. And so that was, you know, the concern we raised, is that we're happy to accept that's happening. We'd like to see that clarity and certainty and assurance reflected in the drafting of the bill. On the examples that we've used, Chair, this was a point that came up in the Portfolio Committee again. If there were more developing economy examples that we could use that had a similar provision, we would have used them, but we don't. Insofar as we've used these particular examples, Minister Patel himself has referenced these examples and in fact said that they go further, and we accept that they go further. But that, again, in our submission was a point that we've made, is insofar as they go further and it's has adverse consequences, adverse economic consequences. Because these are developed economies, that offset can often be shouldered. We think that when that happens in a developing economy like South Africa, as has been made, the real ones who suffer are the ones who can't shoulder the economic consequences of a poor decision or disinvestment. And so we think, that insofar as we've used those examples, those are why we use them. The last point about what is our position on, I guess that's a broader inequality question, and it's on the first page of our submission in our endorsement of the objectives of the bill to address high levels of concentration and skewed ownership profile of the economy. We're very aware of the inherited inequalities that we still live with, that promote structural inequalities, that promote lack of transformation in the private sector. But again, this was a point we made at the start of our presentation, is that there's a role for the department to play here. And we noticed the positive ways, particularly in Minister Patel's budget vote speech, the ways in which the department has played this role to try and balance that inequality that's particularly prevalent in the private sector and the way the private sector engages with transformation goals. And so we don't dispute it, and I think we must make that position clear. What we are disputing is this dichotomy between making South Africa an attractive investment place and creating certainty in the legislation, and then that coming at the cost of protecting our local actors and the local economy. We don't think that that has to come at the cost of each other, and so we want to make that clear. Chair, if I can just point out, what are the things investors care about? I mean, the factors are not, that in contention. They care about regulatory transparency. They care about lack of corruption, tax rates, ease of payment, cost of labor. Those are a point of consensus about what makes this an attractive place for people to want to invest. Insofar as this section, we've raised concerns, it points to the lack of regulatory transparency. The question is not about do we trust Parliament in its wisdom. It's not a question of faith or confidence. This is a matter of the rule of law for us. And insofar as we trust what the rule of law, which the Constitution promotes, that is that when you enact law, the law must be clear. The law must not allow for the potential arbitrary exercise of power, and that's a constitutional imperative and where our motivation comes from.
Sorry, Kate, I just want to ask, does that satisfy the questions answered? If I can just add one, I can't see the honourable member at the back. We have a pillar between us. But if I can just answer directly one of your questions, because I think I was the one who said it about minimising punitive measures. What I meant was just within the narrow context of Section 18A, And the reason for back is simply because I think, as I explained, the onus is wrong. So as a consequence, the punishment may be imposed on someone who is acting in good faith. So that's all I was saying. I'm not making an allegation or putting forward a position as to the broader punitive measures in the bill or in the competition regulation legislature and framework or legislation and framework at large. And then just one more, maybe more direct answer to your question. In terms of what I think you perceived as a contradiction in our submission, on the one hand, what we're saying is that the one option is to take this entire section and put it into a different piece of legislation or position it in a different place in our framework. So take it out of the competition legislation. And if that were to be done, then a lot of our amendments wouldn't be as relevant, and we wouldn't even propose the... So it's an alternative. We're proposing alternative solutions, is my point. The other alternative is to keep it in this Act, and if that is going to be the case, for whatever the justification for that may be, I'm sure I trust that has it's intentional that it's here. Then the rest of our amendments stand, or the rest of our propositions stand, and that is when So that's how all the other amendments could be given effect to in this Act. Yes, that is all for Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the responses. I don't know what are your time constraints. Oh, there is a follow-up question.
If you will allow me, Chair, it becomes a very serious one for me. Can I ask, Mira, do you agree with Chimera on the reference in the final sentence to the committee? She says it's the committee in the Act. I'm saying that refers to this committee. Do you agree with her that it's the committee in the Act, or do you have a different opinion on that, please, sir? The reason why I'm raising it, Chairperson, is because it becomes a very serious issue that we have known that you don't mislead.
I mean, who are you referring the question to?
To Chimera from the Foundation.
Oh, okay. All right.
Can I quickly just read it again for absolute clarity? Honourable Member, I think I understand that in the first part of our submission, we, under introduction, in the first paragraph, we make reference to the Select Committee on Economic and Business Development, and we refer to them as the Select Committee. And then the Competition Amendment Bill, when we speak of the committee, we are referring to the committee made reference to in Section 18A. So I do stand by Chimera's position. I'm sorry if that is ambiguous, because I do not want to allege that this committee is taking irrational decisions. Yes, so that is our position. Thank you for the concern.
Checking if you have time constraints or you will be able to listen to the last presentation by Mr. Daniel Du Plessis, if I need an answer. Because I wanted to explain now what will be the process after all the presentations have been done in your presence. Over to you, sir.
Okay.
Are you having a PowerPoint presentation? Yeah. Oh, very good. It tends to be quick. I was worried about Ellen Foundation, the big document, but they were able to summarize it.
Chair, I always wondered, what is this organization called Saka Liga?
Saka Liga. Afrikaans. Thank you.
Yeah.
Where do people from? You look at here, they go. We play in Nigeria, in Mahara, then we play in the Nelson Mandela Cup, and Manana, you know, the preparation for the World Cup. So we must be careful about this yellow card.
Honourable members, Chairperson, my apologies for the technical difficulties and for the time it took. Seems we have no resolutions. I'll just try and do the best I can with a purely oral presentation. Please do feel free to ask me if there's any confusion. I will try to be as unambiguous as possible considering these constraints. So to start off with, my name is Daniel Plessy. I'm a legal analyst associated with Sakalicha. Sakalicha is a non-governmental organization which represents about 12,800 members, private individuals and businesses. We mostly represent small and medium enterprises, and so many of our members are not represented in EDLAC, FRIBUSA, etc. So this is business coming to the table. We did make oral submissions to the previous iteration of the bills and the bills process, as well as oral submissions at the public hearings. Like the Helen Suzman Foundation, we seem to have found that many of our recommendations have not been incorporated into the bill as it is. after some additional research, then we have presented, or we intend to present today, additional recommendations which were not submitted previously, and which we believe may have serious consequences, and which may be of great importance to the committee's decision. So to start off with, I would like to give a brief overview of my discussion today. I will be focusing on legality and the rule of law, and the excessive, or what we believe to be excessive market intervention by the state. So we would like to refer, as some of the other members or some of the other presenters have done, to the trajectory of South African competition law. We believe this bill does not represent a serious departure from the present trajectory. We believe it is in furtherance of that specific trajectory, and we believe this may be an issue, considering the state that competition law has left South Africa. And it's quite simply, and I don't think there is any serious disagreement on it, it's not working as it should. Currently, South Africa's industrial production is lower than it has been since 2008, so we haven't even recovered our 2008 levels of industrial production. That is a serious problem. We have record levels of unemployment, 27% amongst, you know, the general population, and about 56% by some estimates among the youth. Now, to make maybe divert my attention quickly to this issue, this represents a serious challenge because studies have indicated the longer a youth remains unemployed, the more unemployable they become. This is a ticking time bomb. It's not going to get better. We urgently need to create new jobs for as many people as possible. So, the competition regime in South Africa is distinct, and I would like to take a bit of a global perspective in this presentation. It's distinct from many other jurisdictions in that it takes a public interest component as one of its core mandates. In many jurisdictions, and actually most jurisdictions, with only one or two exceptions, the public interest mandate is largely absent, with competition being the sole purpose of competition regulation. We believe this has had serious consequences, and in the furtherance of this bill, in this bill's new and additional provisions, this may have serious consequences for competition and for South Africa's economic future. Now, to illustrate this, I'll be referring especially to our international trade obligations, which, to my knowledge, have not been considered with regards to this bill before. And I will not be referring to Section 18A. I think the Helen Susan Foundation has covered that quite nicely. So I would like the committee to keep in mind that whatever I say about international competition, this does not also include 18A, which is a further issue, as will become clear. So, to start off with, I would like to take a short tour through some of the key provisions in the bill which are relevant to this presentation. First of all, I would like to start discussing mergers, so that is Section 16.3 and 12A. I believe there is a slight mistake in the presentation that was sent through. So to start off with, we need to discuss the eligibility of investors. Mergers can now be rejected on such grounds as that they do not promote the greater spread of ownership, especially as this relates to historically disadvantaged persons. Now, the intention behind this provision is very laudable, it's very important, but it may have adverse and unforeseen consequences. In this respect, I would implore the committee to consider the hard data on this in this respect and not necessarily what we believe to be or most likely believe to be the case. So to start off with, mergers which may be rejected on the fact that they may adversely impact the vulnerability of national industries to participate in international markets is a further point of concern. This might represent and might be interpreted to represent a seriously protectionist attitude. Now, the implications of this attitude will become clear when I discuss the AGOA later, but the way in which these two sections interact may be deeply problematic. So, the furtherance of the distribution of ownership, especially as it is formulated in the Act at present, may actually adverse impact upon those who have already been empowered, because it means that mergers and acquisitions which actually lessen previously disadvantaged persons' stakeholding in a particular company may be prohibited on public interest grounds. What this comes down to then is you, as a previously disadvantaged individual, cannot sell your own property. You cannot actually trade in your own stocks. This represents a serious infringement of that property right, and it honestly makes it more or less meaningless. The whole purpose of stockholding and of investment is to sell and deal with those investments in a productive way. If you are unable to do so, if you are forced to keep those investments, that does not actually assist you in furthering your own position in life. So that is one key issue here, and it represents a serious infringement of the property rights of those individuals concerned. But furthermore, the fact that we now can refuse mergers on the fact that they may adversely impact upon the ability of national industries to participate in international markets reflects a problematic basis on which this law is actually premised. And that is what I would maybe describe as being an incomplete view of economic production. At the end of the day, a committee such as the one that I'm addressing at the moment must do its very best to, and it's a very difficult task, and for the most part, there's a great deal of special interest groups which come to you and may try to convince you of all sorts of things. So I'm fully aware of the difficult position this committee is in. But the issue of the economy is the issue of the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Ultimately, labor represents one such a resource. The great tragedy of South African unemployment is that these people have a resource that they are unable to trade in the open market. They have their own labor, and that is something which cannot be alienated from them. It is the means by which they can advance themselves in life. If you have a case, if unemployment represents the inability of these people to actually sell that labor to someone else, it means that you have this gift, you have this ability, which you, in principle at least, could use to advance yourself in life by trading it for goods you would rather have than your own labor. But you are unable to do so because it is not economic for anyone else to appoint you to buy that labor from you, as it were. That is the key problem in South Africa at the moment. We are, maybe as a society, for various reasons, disregarding the fact that labor itself is a resource. And so what this represents then is, in the case of the mergers and acquisitions at least, we must consider then what it would mean for international competitiveness to really be open, to have an open market internationally as well. So if we were to say that national industries cannot compete with international industries, the general presumption is that we should be protecting national industries. That is problematic because what it represents is a form of economic nationalism. We are attempting to protect certain specific groups of people to the detriment of South Africa as a whole. If you were to consider the following scenario, say for instance, to take the bread cartel scenario, bread were to suddenly fall from the sky, that would mean a great many businesses would go out of business. But it would be laughable to say that South Africa is worse off economically due to the fact that we've acquired a new resource, a new unlimited resource, in fact. This same principle, just slightly differentiated in terms of price, is the case of international competition. If China were to provide textiles at half the price of local producers, this would mean, yes, that local producers would have to go out of business. But those same producers, the labor they employ, the resources they employ, can be used for other purposes. And although in the short term it would mean that some persons would be disconcerted in their life situation, in the long term it would mean greater prosperity for all, because at the moment we are incurring an opportunity cost. By not using these resources to the most effective, in the most effective way we can, we are in fact throwing away money that could go towards uplifting the very poorest of the poor. The problem with competition regulation is someone needs to pay the price. If we are protecting certain specific industries, well, that's entirely rational from the perspective of Parliament, because Parliament can be lobbied by these industries on an almost one-to-one basis. The consumer, on the other hand, is not represented adequately in this committee. And what that means is that we are, on a basically ad hoc basis, deciding what consumers should be paying more and less for. So let me take this then to the specific provisions in sections 8 and 9 of the bill, of the Act as amended. So, one second. Section 8 of the Act as amended deals with price discrimination. Now, it's important to recognize that the price discrimination that is being discussed in this specific clause is not the same as the price discrimination that generally applies in international terminology. Price discrimination internationally generally refers to charging different consumers different prices for the same product in competition regulation. In this specific instance, it has been actually expanded to also include excessive pricing. The problem with this issue, as has been mentioned earlier, but not adequately explored, is that there is no fair indication of what that price actually should be. And so while my honourable colleague has referred to the fact that there are maybe other legislation or other legislative measures that may be taken to determine what a fair price should be for a given product, that quite simply is not the case. Price is a very relative concept. So the best competition regulatory authorities have been able to do overseas, in the one or two instances that price regulation has actually been attempted, is to take the cost of production and add a small amount that is deemed reasonable for profit. The problem with this approach, as has been demonstrated internationally, and why South Africa is one of the few jurisdictions actually attempting to control price through competition law, is that there is no fixed cost of production. The whole point of the economy is to incentivize lowering production costs. On the other hand, if you earn a percentage point above your actual production costs, that incentivizes you to maximize production costs. And this inefficiency, again, translates into the inefficient use of resources which may be used for other things in the economy. This brings me then to Section 9 of the Constitution, of the Act as amended, which refers to price discrimination by the dominant firm as seller. This, in fact, also constitutes a soft price control. Price controls are universally despised by economists because they are demonstrated to work to the detriment of the consumer. What is the incentive of the producer to actually produce product if he is limited in the maximum amount he can charge? So by analogy, let us consider, for instance, rent control laws in certain cities overseas. New York, London, Brussels, many of these large European cities, and many cities in developing countries as well, have strong price control provisions concerning rent. This means, quite simply, that if you cannot cover adequate costs, if you cannot cover your costs and make a reasonable profit, you are incentivized to actually lower your costs to the extent that you possibly can. This translates into lower quality products for consumers, but it also translates into less production. Less production means more scarcity, which means that although the price of products are artificially limited to be low, they are sold out in first instance, and been redistributed in black markets at a substantial upmark. The implications this has for consumers is simply having less resources to work with. Okay, so to move on to the implications this has for AGOA, and I will be very brief here. South Africa has a mixed history with AGOA. To a large extent, the United States has used it to enforce certain of its policy decisions on the South African state. And while we may disagree with this, we must face the fact that we stand out to lose out on about 100 billion rand of trade either way. Quite simply, South Africa, at the point that we are in our economic situation, we can't afford this sort of trade loss. AGOA is at a very precarious point, precarious moment in its history. We have talk of expropriation without compensation, which has already aroused the interest of the United States trade representatives. But we also have something like the Private Securities Amendment Bill, which very nearly triggered an exclusion of South Africa from AGOA in 2015. We had the poultry subsidies case in 2015 as well. The implications of the bill as it stands are far-reaching. So let's discuss, for instance, the fact that mergers can also only be conducted when it seeks to advance the ownership of previously disadvantaged individuals in that specific South African company. Foreign companies are, by very definition, excluded from that provision. This amounts to a hard trade barrier in many cases, which not only violates the provisions of AGOA, but may also violate international trade law more generally. If we also look at, for instance, at the implications such as the exceptions to anti-competitive behavior in Section 10 of the Act as amended, the possibility exists in the Act, as it will be amended, to actually exclude the operation of Chapter 2, anti-competitive practices, when the anti-competitive practice or the putative anti-competitive practice actually advances the ability of a firm controlled by previously disadvantaged individuals or which is small or medium-sized to participate effectively in the market, to expand its influence into the market, and to enter into the market. Now, by its very definition, any anti-competitive practice will strengthen the ability of a firm to enter and participate into the market. This amounts then to preferential treatment for predominantly South African firms, because no international firm will be able to actually form part of that exception. South African firms then play by a very different system of rules than international firms. Now, disregarding the fact that, you know, having collusion and collusionary sort of practices being allowed by the Competition Act, even if it is to advance previously disadvantaged firms, will disproportionately affect the producer and the consumer, the consumers especially. What this represents then is also a violation of one of the most sacred principles of international trade law, which is equal treatment. If we cannot treat external firms similarly or identically to South African firms, we will again incur the wrath of trade authorities. So AGOA is the specific example I'm using here, but it also has implications for some of the other treaties we are negotiating at the moment and for many of the bilateral investment treaties which are still in force regarding South Africa. Now, there's much more to say, but I suspect I've actually run out of time. And so I will conclude by saying that quite simply, the Act as it is not properly considered, to my the bill as it is not, to my mind, properly considered these factors. And if we pass it now, it represents a serious threat to South Africa's international trade profile, and the eventual effect of that could be to disproportionately adversely affect the poorest of the poor, because international trade and the effective use of resources is really the only way we can create enough value in the South African economy to lift them out of poverty. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, any questions? Honourable Mapuwe, Honourable Terry.
Chair, I wish to thank you very much for the presentation. I'm having difficulties, though, Chair. My first one is, I'm looking at your website, and I'm looking at what you stand for. Mm-hmm. And in your introduction, you said you're an NGO. But in your website, you're representing business interests.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I shouldn't interrupt you, but I thought I meant that clear. Yeah, we represent...
Until I'm finished. So who are you representing, really? Because in your website, it says that you act in the interest of business people. That's what your website says. Unless you want to change your website. My second question related thereto would be, how are you representative of South Africa as a people consisting of different classes, race, cultures, and religions? Are you representative of that? Because I couldn't pick it up from your website. My third question then is, when you talk about youth and new jobs, don't you think that the interventions that has been made by President Cyril Ramaphosa and NEDLAC in the last 2 months will actually address that? We've had the job summit, we've had an investment conference, the presidential one, we've had the African investment conference. As we speak now, the president is in Brussels raising trade, not investment, trade. Because where we're also sitting is that we say, we don't just want the money. Our products must also be able to be the garment workers when they manufacture clothes. It must be exported to Germany and other countries. And we've been very successful in the Western Cape in terms of the production of our wines. People just love our Western Cape wines. But I'm particularly raising on some trade and new jobs. Have you looked at that? Do you think that these efforts by the president is going to be effective or not? My third one is, when you talk about international trade obligations. Now, I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations. So we look at these issues that are happening in the international arena, particularly with regard to the World Trade Organization as well. My position, which I can put publicly, is that we are not happy with what is happening in the global trade arena. And fortunately, I just come out of a meeting of the steering committee of the WTO that was held last month, where many of the members of the steering committee themselves
are also saying, and these represent a whole lot of countries from all the continents of the world, and they're also saying they're not happy. My next question would be, Chair, I have a concern, a serious one, and I quote you, labor is a resource. Do you mean that? I'm saying that labor can't be a commodity. We talk about people when we talk about labor. We've just listened to the trade unions, and I owe it to the trade unions to raise that question with you. My final question, Chair, would just be on the final paragraph that you have in the presentation that I have, where you say that I don't know how I'm going to give it to you. From the top, the second paragraph on your page, on your final page. It says, in our estimation then, such intervention that infringes on the workings of free markets. Now my first question is, would you agree that the free market is not as free as what we would like to see it to be? The second one is then, you then say, freedom in general. Do you think that those that are producing in South Africa are, within the present context, really free?
There we go.
Right? That's my final question.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
You are very much, Honorable Nkeb.
Chair, I'm going to try to be quick. You said consumers are not represented. Yeah, don't you think consumers were represented at the level of NEDLAC? The last page, second paragraph, you say infringing on workings of the free market and freedom in general. This is also partly covered by Braid. You're talking about freedom in general. Don't you think that small businesses that are being impeded upon to access market penetration, their freedom of trade is being impeded upon? When in the textile industry almost collapsed because small businesses were closed, don't you think that their freedom of trade was impeded upon? If you go to page 2, paragraph 3, you're saying your organization stands to encourage transformation, and you therefore encourage that state monopolies should be disbanded. I want to put it to you that this is the economy that we live in now. It's a highly monopolized economy, and the monopolies that are dominant in that economy, they are not state monopolies. They are private or supranational corporations. So if you want to dismantle state monopolies, what about monopolies that are being running amok, owned by supranational corporations? Yesterday we heard that 496 companies in this country are almost running the whole economy of almost 55 million citizens. 496. So what is your view? If you go to page 2, paragraph 1, you're saying this bill is likely to harm business economy. Earlier today, and I suppose you were not here as early as we were, there was an old businessman came here, started a company 40, 50 years ago. Even today, 40, 50 years later, he's still complaining about market penetration. He's still complaining about how bigger corporations are selling shelf space for him. He's still complaining about how markup profit has been carried over by him while he has sold the product to the corporation. He's still complaining about being closed off the market 40, 50 years later. So this likely business community harm, how does it, what is your organization view about small businesses that have been closed off perpetually by bigger corporations? Because nowhere in your presentation do you speak about freedom of trade for smaller businesses. Thank you, Chair.
I count about 10 questions. I'm going to try and get to all of them, but if I do miss anyone, I do apologize, and I would like you to make me aware of that fact. So to start off with the Honourable Member's question about who we actually represent, we are an NGO created by and for business, but we also take it as part of our mandate. So many small businessmen came together to actually create our organization because, well, they passionately believe in the operation of the free market and the creation of conditions conducive to that free market. So that's our initial mandate came from there. And I do believe these things are compatible because what's good for business can, in many circumstances, be good for South Africa as a whole. The private sector represents a powerful engine for change and transformation and the creation of wealth, which can be distributed to all South Africans. And that is passionately the position that we are coming from. I hope that makes sense. So we as an organization, we're created out of the Afrikaans community. So we are not, as of yet, entirely representative of South Africa. And this because we do not presume to be representative of the entirety of South Africa. What we represent is, in the first instance, is business, because business to a large extent cannot afford to be prejudicial. If you were to look at the history of South Africa during the apartheid era of government had the big difficulty it had was enforcing separation and segregation despite business's best efforts, because business is one that is as dispassionate as possible about where the inputs you use come from. And so while the individual business owners may be racist or may be prejudiced, they are quickly weeded out when other people can provide better value to consumers by the use of more inclusive staff, more inclusive suppliers, etc., etc. So that is the premise that we are operating on. And so that brings it to the next question the Honourable Member asked with regard to the initiatives by the Honourable President. To a large extent, we are slightly sceptical due to the historical context that we are in currently. If you were to look at, say, for instance, the American history just before the Great Depression, President Hoover made serious efforts to go to the private industry to ask them not to have layoffs, to invest more in plants and capital, etc., etc. The problem is business does not control the economy. The government does not control the economy. What it represents to a large extent is a system which is divorced from any specific one locus of control. Even if business does its very level best to have the country operate as efficiently as possible, even if it does its very best to save us from recession, it quite simply cannot do so if the conditions are not conducive to it. The free market and the market in general then represents an almost dispassionate system. If the structural concerns which underlie our situation are not addressed, there's nothing that the president or business can do about it. So while the initiatives and while investment is always a good thing, as many companies as possible should, of course, invest in South Africa. This capital will allow us to do much to improve the lot of all South Africans. The problem is that, you know, investment that is made without proper rationale, investment that is made without the very basement of society being reformed to be conducive to economic development, will eventually just turn out to be wasted efforts. So that's our position. But we do believe there is cause for hope. We just need to be very careful about how we manage our economic future from here on onward. So with regards to the international trade obligations that South Africa is subject to, I would like to have a two-pronged answer here. And that's, while we are not entirely happy, of course, with the international trade situation as it is, we must face the fact that in the short term at least, we are subject to many, especially with regard to something like AGOA, many external factors that we just simply do not have control over. AGOA, for instance, is entirely within the discretion of the American state to actually just end unilaterally, considering especially that it is a unilateral trade arrangement. So if we were to fail to appease them, that unfortunately does mean that we lose out on that. And in the second place, disregarding the actual rules of the I do believe there's a strong case to make that many of the rules of the International Trade, World Trade Organization, etc., have a laudable purpose. Even disregarding these rules, we must consider that the soft policy implications of our decisions. Even if we were to say, let's ignore the rules, let's just play by what we want to do, business and industry are very unlikely to invest in South Africa if we do not make the environment conducive to them. If we say, for instance, you are not allowed to have a controlling stake in a South African company, that adversely affects the incentive to invest in South Africa. If we say you are allowed to invest in South Africa, but local firms will actually be able to use business practices that which would be prohibited to you, that disincentivizes firms entering the market because they know that they will be at a competitive disadvantage. Of all American investment, only about 1% is invested in the developing world. And that means, well, there's not a lot of money to go around, and many other developing countries clamoring for this money. We need to consider the fact that we need to be a competitive business destination. And what that comes down to is we need to show that we can make their money grow, and the best way we can do that is to use it as efficiently as possible to have as much certainty in its application as possible, if that makes sense. This brings me then to the next question. Labor is a resource, and I understand your concerns with this. I'm going to say that labor as a productive human activity is definitely a resource, but we must not mistake me, is that resource in the first instance belongs to the worker. The worker is the one who actually controls that labor in the first instance. We have a situation where we have people, the only resource they have, in fact, is their own labor. The only thing they have in this world, apart from maybe a shack and some food some days, is the ability to do things, to build things, to have a life they build for themselves. And what the South African situation, the tragedy of the South African situation at present, is this resource has been artificially limited. People are not allowed to sell their labor. They're not allowed to use the only resource that they have within their control. And this might be due to regulatory constraints in some cases, but it might also just be to the fact that there's a dearth of economic development. So if you control only your own body in this world, and we say you're not allowed to use it, if the situation is no one can pay you to use it, that is a desperate situation to be in. And I believe that should be our first priority, is in firstly empowering people wherever they are to use their own abilities to the fullest of the extent that they possibly can. But I understand your concerns with the way I phrased that. It might be something to consider in the future. So regards to something like the free market, to the extent that it is really free, which I believe was the final question you asked me, Honourable Member, I believe to a large extent there is much contention about what a free market actually means in practice. In the South African situation, the market is still largely free in the sense that we have a ability to determine price based on actual need in many cases. What this amendment does, it infringes upon these vestiges of a free market, because what it comes down to is it actually limits producers and it limits consumers and what they're allowed to buy and at what prices. If that's not an infringement of freedom, I'm not sure exactly what it means. So it's important to distinguish, and I think this also addresses the question raised by the other honourable member, between what we can call almost ontological conceptual freedom and actual material freedom. So what you can do in practice and the means that you have to actually carry out your will in the world, if that makes sense, material sort of freedom. Now, the best way to actually encourage both of these types of freedom is to trust consumers and to trust companies. If, for instance, a company fails to be competitive, if it doesn't sell its products at a price which consumers find compelling, then it is arbitrary and irrational to force consumers to buy it at that price in any case. So let's make this practical. If we have a barber shop selling bread at 5 rand a piece and Checkers selling it at 2 rand a piece, the cost that we incur in forcing Checkers to sell at 5 rand is a cost that is paid by those consumers. Now, of course, that means that the barber shop has become less viable. But this just means that there is a comparative disadvantage which can be exploited by that specific business person. The nature of economics is that some organizations, and this applies to international trade as well, some organizations and countries have an absolute advantage. They can quite simply produce everything we can. They can do it better, at higher quality, for cheaper and quicker. That is the economic reality we're facing. the only thing we really have to our own advantage is that there are certain products which we are less disadvantaged in producing. The best products we can produce of our time. Okay. Now, I don't have time to get into this in full detail, but I would advise members of the committee who are interested in reading up on Ricardian economics, and specifically the works of Ricardo, which is established, which is part of the canon of economics since about the 18th century. It's a well-established fact that sometimes the best you can do is literally doing the least worst thing, and that is what we are advocating in this specific instance. Now, to wrap this up, to get to the honourable members' questions at the back there, with regards to NEDLAC representation, consumers aren't properly represented at NEDLAC. NEDLAC represents specific interest groups, so it's a principal agent problem. It's international as well. It's a very common occurrence, a very common phenomenon. Where certain groups of people have more of an interest in regulatory authorities than other groups of people. And ironically enough, the people who have the greatest amount of interest in a regulatory authority are those institutions and people being regulated by that authority. So if there is a federal if there's a commission that, say, regulates electricity, ESCOM has by far the largest incentive to care about that regulatory authority. Individual consumers have no interest, because individual consumers quite simply cannot care about everything. They need to survive, and first and foremost, have their own lives and jobs and relationships. And they're just quite simply busy. There's a small group of people who are disproportionately affected by those regulatory authorities. And NEDLAC is the same issue here, is the members of NEDLAC are disproportionately affected by NEDLAC and have a disproportionate interest in NEDLAC. But the decisions taken at NEDLAC influence those individuals who are not properly represented at NEDLAC. So that's basically every South African. Let's illustrate this with a simple thought exercise. How often do you think does the average South African even think about NEDLAC? Do they even know it exists? So by its very definition, they are not represented at NEDLAC, and so I would maybe just appeal to the committee to consider this fact in its considerations and deliberations. So with regards to something like the free market and freedom in general, freedom of trade being impeded upon... Oh, okay, so small industries and freedom of trade being impeded upon. So again, this is a different definition of freedom that we need to consider within its full context. If we say we want to make it easier for the spaza shop to compete against Checkers, that means we are privileging the spaza shop owner above the consumer. The consumer, in this last instance, must pay for the bread. It amounts to a tax on the very poorest of the poor. It's about 150% VAT on that specific piece of bread, and that's just not conscionable. So what I would suggest is that we must find the best value for the consumer in whatever we do. And if that means that Checkers drives a specific spaza shop, a spaza shop out of business, that is unfortunate, but it amounts to a win for the consumer in the long term. These owner of the spaza shops, I think that is my chief problem with the bill as it is. The bill reflects a lack of faith in these small business owners. We must accept that sometimes businesses do go out of business. That is the nature of life. Most new businesses fail. But all large businesses start as small businesses. If you consider the large American retailers, for instance, such as Sears, Walmart, etc., they all started with peddlers, with individuals selling small amounts of products, maybe as few as 10 a day, to consumers, giving the best value to those consumers and using that gap in value to grow. That is what we should seek to advance at the moment, and the bill does not do so. State monopolies, with regard to state monopolies, quite honestly, monopoly in general is a bad thing. But monopoly can only properly exist when there is privileged access to the market. And that can occur by several means. It can occur by something as natural as, say, economy of scale. But the primary means by which it can occur is lack of entrance into the market. And South Africa's got that issue at the moment. There's a lack of new entrance into the market. And something like these amendments to the Competition Act doesn't address that bottleneck. The bottleneck is not in small businesses which then fail. Those rates are more or less what you'd expect from any economy, especially a developing economy. The problem in South Africa is new businesses starting and being formalized, and the bill will not seek to advance this specific bottleneck, this specific issue. So I don't think we're looking at the right place with regard to this specific bill. And then finally, with regards to something like market penetration, and the gentleman you mentioned, profit not being carried over to him, etc., that is unfortunate. But if we were to force consumers to bear the cost of his increase in market penetration, that just seems unconscionable to me. This business person has more means than the very poorest of the poor, and it's very strange to suggest, to me at least, and I do not mean any disrespect, my apologies, that was badly phrased, but I would think it would be almost cruel to have the consumers pay this ad hoc rate based on what the economic need of any specific business person is in that moment. Market penetration is increased when consumers find the best value in a business. If consumers don't find better value in your business than anywhere else, forcing consumers to buy from that business represents a serious infringement not only of their freedom, but also of their own economic prospects. And with that, I believe I've taken quite a while, I think that is basically it. So in summary, our recommendation would be to seriously reconsider the bill as it is, because it does not address the key issues that really affect most South Africans, and it actually represents a serious infringement of the legal certainty that is crucial to establishing South African business.
Thank you very much for the responses to the question. This was the last stakeholder was presented in this process of the public hearings. We received about 19 submissions. 8 have come forward to conduct oral presentations. This was the last one. I'm going to outline the process moving forward. But let me appreciate particularly those who have come forward to make oral presentations. It helps us a lot as members of Parliament in that, you know, when the bill is presented to us as members, it doesn't mean much to us as members, even with the briefing by a department, it doesn't really mean much until such time we receive submissions from the public, and it even becomes more when we receive the oral presentation. It also allows us now to go back to the bill itself. You know, the bill, the way it is structured, it's not friendly. You wouldn't understand it, the ordinary person. But when you look at the submissions, you look at the briefing by the department, you look at the submissions by stakeholders, you listen to the engagements, oral engagement by the stakeholders, and then it makes sense. And then when you go back to the bills, you now look at those specific areas that were highlighted by the stakeholders. So therefore, in the absence of the stakeholders coming forward with their submissions, you know, the bills in their nature would be meaningless. It would just be something that is technical. You look at the bill, it tells you who's the initiator of this bill, whether it's the minister or a portfolio committee. And then at the end, it gives you the bill number. It means nothing. And then you go to the purpose, it clarifies the purpose. Still, it doesn't mean anything. It goes to the definition, the purpose, and all the other sections. So the point I'm making is the appreciation of the stakeholders to come forward to make their presentation. It's really helping us a lot, because from now we will be then going back to the bills and try to make sense of what are the issues. But I also understand that some of the presentation by stakeholders Some are political, broader political statements, others are ideological in nature, others are legalistic, others are focusing on interests that the stakeholders represent, be it business interests or worker interests. So, but when we sit down as a committee, we shift out the things like broad political statements and the ideological statements, and we look at the purpose, what is the bill seeks to do, and really focus on that and see whether the inputs by the stakeholders are taking forward the object of the bill, and they are taking the country forward. So that's what we consider as members of parliament. And therefore, this process of a public hearing is not just a malicious compliance with the constitution. We're not just ticking the boxes. We seriously consider the inputs made by the stakeholders. Something that they are also empowering us. But I must also hasten to say that whilst we consider them seriously, we're not obliged as members to agree with each and every point that is made by the stakeholders. We're not obliged. So I'm going back to the issue that you made your inputs in the NA, and therefore, because they were not taking, they were not in, included in the B bill, and therefore you're not happy with that. The point for us as members of parliament is to seriously consider the positions, the input that you make. We even record the input that you make. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we will include those inputs if we are not convinced as members. We won't include them in the bill if we are not. But we do take it into consideration, serious consideration. Sometimes we even, they help us to amend the bill. It's not that as a select committee we just endorse anything that comes from the National Assembly. We do make amendments, further amendments, to the amendments that have been made by the National Assembly Portfolio Committee. The example I want to make is there was a bill that was referred to our committee by the National Assembly. It's called the adjudication or administrative adjudication of road traffic offenses. Bill, amendment bill. That bill, we deliberated, we stakeholders made their input. In fact, it even went to the provinces because it's a Section 76 bill. Provinces also made their own inputs, and then we finally discussed and deliberated and voted on the bill. We made amendments on that bill. It came from the NA, but we still made amendments. I will be tabling that bill in the plenary session of the National Council of Provinces next week on Tuesday, on the 27th. You're welcome to attend. So the point I'm making is that we don't just agree to what the National Assembly proposes. We do make amendments. But also, at the same time, we may agree with everything that the National Assembly is proposing. So I wanted to clarify so that some should not say that all we do as a select committee is just to endorse what the National Assembly is saying. From time to time we do make amendments, not only this committee, but there are other committees as well. In fact, the NA is sitting now with the bills that are coming from the National Council of Provinces, because there are amendments that have been made by the National Council of Provinces. In fact, with this one of the topic, the department was actually not here because they thought that we would pass this bill this year. for them, it means when we table it on the 27th, sorry, it's not next week, on the 27th, it means it can only go back to the National Assembly next year, because the week of the 27th will be the last week here in Parliament. So the chances of that bill being operational, it's nil, because it must still now go back to the committee of the National Assembly, and then after that it will go to the plenary session of the National Assembly. So that the point I'm clarifying again is that we do make amendments convinced by the stakeholders and also by the input of the department. So the process now is that because we have concluded now with the public hearings, we will allow the department to respond to each and every input that was made here, including those submissions that were not presented in the committee orally. Some of the submissions are not really talking to the issue. The submission, see the committee secretary, I thought she was going to take it out of the submissions. It's written, not even written to the committee, it's written to the president. Somebody wants to be assisted with money. It's got nothing to do with the committee. Another one is from, I don't want to mention names, but it's more referring to the land. Also, even in, with regard to the land, to the KZ land. Got nothing to do with the competition. I don't know how then the department is going to respond to those. We forwarded them to the department, but we'll see how then the department is going to respond to those submissions. But the point I'm making that all the submissions, oral and those that were written, but the stakeholders opted not to come and present them orally, they will all be responded to. That will take place on Monday in Johannesburg at the Howard Tambo Hotel. We have a program of the National Council of Provinces, so it will be back to back with that program. So those who are available, because the parliamentary meetings are open to public, so those who are friends are able to attend. Especially those who come from Captain can attend the meeting and see how the department is responding to those. But then on Wednesday, we will then deliberate as a committee on the input of the stakeholders, the responses of the department, and then we will adopt a report and we vote on the bill, clause by clause, starting from the cover page, whether we agree with what is contained in the cover page, the purpose of the bill, and so on and so on. And then we hope that once we agree to with the amendment or without amendment, or we even reject the bill as you are suggesting, we may agree with you, they may reject the bill, and then we report. Still, that will have to be ATC that we have rejected the bill. And then we must still go back to the plenary session of the NCOP to present a report that which says we have rejected the bill, or which says we have adopted the bill with or without amendment. So that is going to be the process going forward. Then the NCOP plenary session will then vote whether they agree with us to reject the bill or they agree with the amendments with our report. Because it's Section 75, it means therefore members of the NCOP individuals will have to vote on the bill, and then the majority will then decide whether to adopt the bill. So this is a process going forward with regard to. So let me explain this, because this is the last public hearing process. So I'm just clarifying then what is the way forward. We tentatively we hope that on the 30th, it will be on Friday, unfortunately, that session, the plenary session of the NCOP will be on Friday. We hope that then we will table the report to the plenary session on the 30th of November. Again, you are welcome to come, but you will be in the public gallery this time. But also on Monday, when the department is responding, and also when we are deliberating, you'll just be observers. You won't say a word. Even if you disagree with what the department is saying, you'll just observe what the department is saying. And also you observe when we deliberate as members on Wednesday. So that is the process going forward. Thank you very much for attending and also making presentation. Thank you to everyone who has come and observed. Welcome you. You must continue to come to these sessions. We welcome your attendance.
But on our program for next week, I'm becoming confused now, Chair. Can I request that Martins and Grace talk to each other so that you send us something formal as to when, what day and what time we will be meeting, please, Chair.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.